Ascent Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Tree of Life and Prosperity, 21st Century Business Principles from the Book of Genesis, by Michael A. Eisenberg. Narrated by Tristan Morris. Publisher's Note. In this audio edition, you may hear references to visual elements present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Preface. My wife thinks that I look at everything through an economic lens, and I am guilty as charged. The world is inherently, naturally, economic. In the words of the wisest of all men, money is the answer to everything. Ecclesiastes, chapter 10, verse 19. Or as Liza Minnelli sang in Cabaret, money makes the world go round. Moral and ethical principles are, in my view, part of an economy's foundations and drivers, so I view my wife's words as a compliment, even a blessing. The co-head of the yeshiva where I studied when I was 19 years old, Rabbi Yehuda Amital, once challenged me to move to Israel and open a plant that would employ 10,000 people earning a dignified living. He told me that this would be the best way to fulfill the great mitzvah, commandment, to settle Eretz Yisrael, the land of Israel, for a good living is the basis for sustaining a family and a society. I do not yet own such a plant, and I do not know whether the companies I've invested in employ as many as 10,000 people in Israel, so I do not consider myself at liberty to desist from Rabbi Amital's challenge. His words encourage me to reread the equation in both directions. The Torah and commandments are influenced by economics, and also influence it. This book, the first volume of a five-volume series, one for each book of the Bible, seeks to lay bare the fundamentals of modern economics and to show that systemic understanding and daily encounters with the reality of contemporary economies gives a completely different perspective on the Torah. That same Torah informs economics as well. Throughout this book, we will encounter contemporary economic issues such as the universal basic income promoted by Facebook founder Mark Zuckerberg, Tesla founder Elon Musk, and one-time presidential and current New York City mayoral candidate Andrew Yang, among others, which Adam and the Garden of Eden already faced. The initiatives and inventions of both Noah and Alfred Nobel will come into focus. Abraham and Andrew Carnegie will develop divergent approaches to wealth, and Jacob and Laban will behave in accordance with the principles of game theory. After we see dramatic economic changes relating to agriculture, urbanization, and the undesirable results of too much market intervention, we will conclude with entrepreneurs and managers and their impact on national economies and values. Along the way, we will meet Esau, whose lifestyle was incompatible with the economic changes taking place around him, and who was unable or unwilling to adapt. The world of the 21st century, which is undergoing a radical change from an industrial to a technological economy, raises the same questions. Will everyone adapt? Is the world compatible with everyone's lifestyles and skills? What about societies that are not yet industrial? The Book of Genesis is a foundational document for a real-world economy, and contemplating it is vital. The global economy is shifting from an industrial paradigm to one driven by knowledge and data. Nations and states are torn by social economic rifts and political upheaval. Under changing conditions, we must always seek out first principles. These are what anchor our lives and constitute our moral conscience. Family, social, and moral values are part of the laws of economics. A model that examines the values expressed by the economy and chooses to work toward realizing the best ones is a recipe for economic, financial, and political success. What I have learned as an investor. My years of venture capital investment have taught me that one of the strongest signals of a good investment is when everyone who hears about it thinks it is impossible, impractical, or even foolish. My first professional investment was in a company called Picture Vision. It was 1995, and the internet was still in its infancy. I was sitting on a plane to Tel Aviv, next to Gur Shomron, a veteran high-tech entrepreneur, and we got to talking. I was young and curious, but completely inexperienced. I had heard Gur's name before, but did not meet him until that moment when we were sitting next to each other in uncomfortable economy seats. Gur was well over 6 feet tall, and I am a bit above 6 feet. He had a heavy Israeli accent, and I was a young, recent American immigrant to Israel. At some point, he said to me, "I have a friend, really an acquaintance, near Jerusalem. He is having a hard time raising funds. He has an idea related to the internet. Have you heard anything about that?" Several days later, I received a call at our small office in Jerusalem from someone identifying himself as Yaakov Ben Yaakov. To tell the truth, I thought it was my cousin prank calling me from the United States. It took me a few minutes to realize that Yaakov Ben Yaakov was actually a real person, an entrepreneur with a startup company that had developed an early method for transferring images over the internet. Today, it seems simple, but back then, people were still using cameras with film and negatives, and the internet was running on dial-up modems. We could barely keep our email running smoothly in Jerusalem, so I did not believe he would manage to transfer images. But my curiosity got the better of me. I traveled to Givat Ze'ev, a suburb of Jerusalem. There, in the home of Yaakov ben Yaakov, with the children gallivanting around the house, we sat in his attic with a plate of supermarket cookies and a bottle of Coca-Cola, and he proudly presented his development. I would end up spending many more long hours in that attic, in unbearable heat or with the din of rain on the roof. But that first visit was barely over 2 hours. Yaakov scanned a negative, uploaded the file to a local computer, and over the course of more than an hour, he transferred it over the internet to another computer via a landline. Just displaying the picture on the second computer took 2 minutes and several clicks of the refresh button. Yaakov's venture was penniless, and he was living off the fumes of an idea that was not yet a business. Other investors, including those suggested by Gur Shomron, had rejected it, yet something about it enchanted me. I had immigrated to Israel with my wife in 1993, 2 years before. Our family still lived abroad, and we now had a baby girl. The idea that we could send pictures to our parents and grandparents overseas excited me more and more every time I saw it done. Today we called this photo sharing, but we did not know what to call it then, because Picture Vision was the first to do it. As noted, I was a novice investor. I knew nothing, so I called a lot of experienced investors. Some asked, "What's an internet?" Some thought it would be impossible to send a picture over a line with such narrow bandwidth. Like our daughter, the internet was still in diapers, and the Israeli venture capital industry was likewise in its infancy. Sophisticated investors asked where they would find all the scanners for the negatives and where and how we would install them. In a word, impossible. Nevertheless, despite the skepticism, the doubters, and the risk, my partner, Shlomo Kalish, and I pledged to invest about $50,000 in the company, although we did not have the money. In addition, we would help the company raise money in exchange for a cash fee and some warrants to buy stock. Picture Vision was clearly somewhat desperate to use novices like us, and we were somewhere on the spectrum between over-optimistic and reckless. Our naive assumption was that if we succeeded, we would receive a fee in the amount of $50,000, and that would be the investment that we committed to Yaakov and his partners. We contacted private investors and asked if they wanted to send pictures to their nearest and dearest through something called the internet. In essence, we were working with the crowdfunding concept that is so popular today, in which people pre-order a product that is under development. We did not have a crowd, but we did find a handful of believers. These were not typical angels as they are now known, a concept that would have been foreign to most of the investors we contacted. Fast forward a bit more than 2 years, and the dying company from Givat Ze'ev was sold to then communications giant AOL and photography giant Kodak. Those initial investors, who were following their hearts and a vision of what could be over what was solid and established, multiplied their investment more than tenfold. While this was not a venture capital home run, it was a very meaningful outcome for the earliest investors. In retrospect, this story reflects the strategy for both investing and living that I have tried to apply for the past quarter century. Strategy often starts as passion or instincts driven by your unique way of looking at the world of investments. It is comprised of the knowledge and insights you developed or fused from your education, experiences, and beliefs. Every product has an underlying theme and advances an agenda. Behind every transaction and innovation, there are people. Human spirit has been invested in every technological development. Every negotiation of value is influenced by the principles of the parties involved. There are some people whose transactions reflect the principles they champion, and those principles influence how they determine economic value. The investors in picture vision were people whom the importance of keeping in touch with distant family members resonated strongly. Daniel Kahneman, after collaboration with Amos Tversky, won a Nobel Prize for suggesting that humans were not strictly rational economic beings. Venture capital, where I have spent the last 25 years of my professional life, is a service business. We service entrepreneurs, who are the heroes of innovation, and the ones who propel the world forward by leaps and bounds, mostly improving our lives along the way. However, entrepreneurs generally, and technology entrepreneurs specifically, are not rational economic beings. There are easier ways for bright and ambitious people to make money. What they truly want to do is make change. They are impelled by a need to change something, to fix or improve it. In my world, their canvas is technology. Broadly, there are three investment strategies for a venture capitalist. You can invest in a technology change, in a market evolution or revolution, or in people. As venture capitalist Keith Raboy says, you can make money at all three, but you better be among the best at one of them. I do not know much about technology and markets, so I focus on people. I started off investing with no strategy that I could explain. I was curious, driven, and in many ways desperate to prove myself. I had a degree in political science, whatever that means, and edited the college newspaper, and even created some troubles for my university's administration. But mostly, I had spent my time studying Torah. In retrospect, it is fair to say that my investment strategy reflected more of my Torah values than science, technology, and markets. Perhaps this is passion, re-narrated as strategy. One of the key attributes of Torah study is havruta, or learning in pairs. If you have ever been to a house of Torah study, you will hear pairs of students yelling at each other, arguing over ancient and modern texts that cover almost every realm of life from holidays and blessings to economics and torts. The leading yeshivas actually spend most of their time on the tractates that cover economics and torts. Many approaches to Torah view within it hidden, even mystical meanings. Others provide metaphysical interpretations, many of which are necessary and important. Still others use the text as a diving board into homiletics. For me, it is real life. After this first volume of my series on the Torah came out in Hebrew, Rabbi Benny Lau remarked, "I learned from your book that people are people, economics is economics, and families are families. Things have not changed fundamentally in thousands of years since the Torah was written." I think he is right. Our biblical patriarchs and matriarchs were great people, and the Torah provides eternal truths, but we can only learn them if we are willing to say they are applicable, that people are people, that Abraham had family issues and dealt with wealth and economic hardship, that Isaac had family strife and had to reinvent his business and shift his livelihood from livestock to farming, that Jacob had tension with his wives and children, and hence in his family business, and that Joseph's rags-to-riches story shows that you can create policy responses to economic crises, but you cannot predict their outcomes. At the same time that we strive for Torah-inspired moral clarity and greatness, We must apply its relevant lessons and examples to everyday challenges. Woven into the stories it tells is timeless wisdom about ethics and values. These lessons permeate the text and are an integral part of the narrative. When people seek my advice, I often tell them that I would not ask someone like me for guidance. After all, who would ask someone for advice who is wrong as often as he is right? The venture capital business can be brutal. Half the time, you lose your money. You invest in the unknown, live with uncertainty, and often snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. In sum, it is a business steeped in faith. Faith that the future will be better. Faith in people, entrepreneurs, and changemakers. And in my case, a faith in God and the eternal wisdom of the Torah. Like film and gaming, venture capital is commonly referred to as a home run business. More accurately, it is a grand slam home run business. Similar to Hollywood or gaming, where most products fail, most technology startups fail as well. A small number succeed, and they can succeed big. One venture investment in eBay, Facebook, Cisco, or Google can make up for a lot of losing ones. Still, according to Correlation Ventures, out of 21,000 venture financings from 2004 to 2014, 65% lost money. 2.5% of investments made 10 to 20 times their money. 1% made more than 20 times return. And half of 1%, only about 100 companies, earned 50 times or more. Sometime in 2005, I decided to reflect on my failures. I came to 3 conclusions. First, I know little about technology, and the more complex technology involved in the investment, the worse I do. At a minimum, I need to be able to explain it to other people so that they know I am not completely making it up. Second, even in my failures, if I stood up for what was right, I was proud of the investment, even if it was less financially successful. Moreover, that ethical stance was reputation building. Lastly, I had not spent enough time with certain founders and co-investors to see if we had common values. I concluded that shared values and a culture of ethics, excellence, and innovation matters a lot. This was not an investment in the stock market or an exchange-traded fund. It was an investment in people you had to believe in. It was almost a marriage. One particularly nettlesome investment involved the digital imaging space. I understood the company, and we even had good people. When the tech bubble burst in 2001, its board decided not to pay severance to employees in the United States and instead focused on an Asian market. This was too much for me to accept. Together with the CEO, I objected, was outvoted, and resigned from the board immediately. As the Torah says, "Do not keep with you the wages of your laborers until the morning." Leviticus chapter 19, verse 13. Here I failed twice. I lost our investors' money and failed to persuade the board that we needed to pay U.S. employees. More deeply, however, I failed in my investment philosophy. The trend the company bet on and the product it created became successful. They were the inventor of the now popular photo book, which many households have today to show off their digital pictures in paper form. We picked a lousy business strategy, trying to build everything ourselves instead of partnering with printing houses. However, more troubling was that when the chips were down, there was an ethical failing. Reflecting on that caused me to double down and search for greater guidance from the Torah. When Daniel Schreiber pitched me his idea for a new type of insurance company in the area he initially called P2P Insurance, I responded immediately. Daniel and I had been friends for 30 years. We had studied in yeshiva together. I'd backed his first company, Alchemedia, which was, shall we say, not exactly a roaring success. However, Daniel was a leader, a fearless entrepreneur, and a mensch. After coffee and a croissant at Cafe Michael in Jerusalem, he laid out a plan for building a new kind of insurance company from the ground up, a company that would align its interests with its customers instead of making money when it made its customers miserable by rejecting their claims. Daniel was not a technologist, but talked about the power of data, AI, and behavioral economics with only a PowerPoint. He did not yet have product or technology, but I knew I wanted to invest. This was an idea rooted in values and giving back to the community of policyholders, and it was a fundamental values-driven change. It probably helped that even a technological idiot like me could explain it. I introduced Daniel to Shai Winiger, a product and technology whiz I had known for a decade. Shai was also a visionary who saw and promoted the good technology could create. He was a unique entrepreneur and a person of deep values and boundless creativity, and he had a deep desire to make the world a better place. Shai did not go to yeshiva with me, nor was he raised on learning Torah, but he reflected those values in his own way. Lemonade, so named because when life gives you lemons, insurance should give you lemonade, did not yet have an insurance license. It was a coin flip as to whether they would be granted one by the regulators in NYC. The fledgling company needed a lot of money up front. Moreover, these inspired entrepreneurs were seeking a 10 times change in a stodgy, conservative industry, as well as a fundamental values-based realignment. But we were in. As the Torah says, when you see the ass of your enemy lying under its burden and would refrain from raising it, you must nevertheless raise it with him. Exodus chapter 23, verse 5. Before the beginning. We do not often speak about principles in a world of balance sheets, contracts, and markets. The dry letter of the law obliges us to focus on the bottom line, the profits of a company and its stakeholders. This is the fiduciary duty of the board of directors, and rightly so. In the course of our daily lives, it is not always convenient to clarify and sharpen our moral principles as we consume, transact, and forge personal and economic relationships. But it is likely the difference between success and failure. This does not mean that scoundrels do not make money. It means that their bad practices eventually catch up with them. It means that in a world that is becoming ever more transparent, ethics in business and the values of brands and products will be scrutinized more and will differentiate winners from losers. In 1989, when I was a first-year student at Yeshivot Har Etzion, in a small town called Alon Shvot in the Judean hills, 30 minutes south of Jerusalem, I approached Rabbi Dr. Aaron Lichtenstein with a youthful question. Like many American Orthodox Jewish kids, I spent a year studying Torah at an Israeli yeshiva. I just finished my freshman year at Yeshiva University in New York. At YU, you studied Torah in the morning and liberal arts in the afternoon. I was 18 and impressionable, but even thirstier for knowledge. Rabbi Lichtenstein was the reason I had chosen this yeshiva. He had emigrated to Israel in the early 1970s, giving up a clear path to success at YU, where he was likely to become the head of the institution. To us, Rebbe, as we called Rabbi Lichtenstein, cast a tall, imposing figure and possessed a towering intellect. More importantly, he was a beacon of ethics. As my friend Rabbi Amnon Bazak has said, everybody's heart skipped a beat when they approached him with a question. Over my time in yeshiva, Rabbi Lichtenstein's work ethic, clear moral compass, and personal example of leadership were key sources of inspiration for me and thousands of other students. Those were the days of cassette tapes, which could be inserted into a radio cassette player to record and listen to music. I had a double cassette player, which allowed me to copy music from one tape to another. I asked Rabbi Lichtenstein whether halakha, Jewish law, allows you to copy music that you had purchased to another cassette. His answer made a strong impression. If you bought it, then it is permitted. They cannot tell you what to do with the tape once you have purchased it. However, you will not win any medals for fulfilling "You Shall Be Holy." Rabbi Lichtenstein clearly meant that one must distinguish between what is permitted and what is appropriate and proper. His reference to the commandment, "Be holy," alluded to the comments of Ramban, Nachmanides. One should not be a scoundrel with the license of the Torah. In other words, don't be a jerk and then justify yourself by pointing to the letter of the law. I tell this story to my children every year on the Sabbath when we read the Torah portion where this verse appears. The importance of this message opens a window to an issue that is far from simple: the reciprocal relationship between law and morality. Law is a structured framework, and as such, it is unable to capture the full complexity of the human condition. Laws are crafted and administered by the state, religions, or other bodies in an attempt to order societies. Ethics and morals fill in many gray areas. It is these normative, universal, and religious dictates that requires adherence. However, these dictates can often come into conflict in practical ways, even if they derive from the same sources. They also prepare us for life, in which we often encounter scoundrels, even scoundrels clothed in religious rhetoric or cloaking behind religious laws, and are frequently tempted to cut ethical corners ourselves. Today, almost 30 years since I left yeshiva, I have concluded that Rabbi Lichtenstein was righter than he knew. Principles, ethics, and morals are not merely questions of lifestyle that parallel the laws of economics. They must also be part of its foundations. My claim is that principles affect worth. Values improve value, especially in the modern digital age. Capitalism is a fundamental engine of change and growth. It is, perhaps, the greatest driver of human potential, innovation, and improvement in human history. Innovation and freedom are the fuel that drives it. However, without timeless ethics and morals, both the system and individual business can become runaway trains that can run over others, or, as we will see with Noah, subvert humanity itself. Today, people are moving more and more toward ethical investments. While each person defines his ethics slightly differently, ethical investing is unquestionably gaining momentum. Environment, social, and governance-based funds, often called sustainable funds, grew 4 times from 2018 to 2019, reaching over $20 billion of capital inflows. Consumers are checking the ethical practices of brands and choosing not to support those that use sweatshops or fossil fuels. Most of this attention has been focused on environmental issues. Lemonade, for example, announced that it would not invest in fossil fuel companies. We can debate each company's ethical stance, but we cannot deny that consumers and investors increasingly look for investment decisions that reflect their personal values and ethics. Principles are part of all successful business considerations. They built the economy, the free market, reputations, and long-term wealth, not short-term economic strategies that were greedy and impatient. Principles are part of every product, service, and economic decision, not just an external balance or break. As my friend Mark Benioff, founder and CEO of Salesforce.com, says, "Building a successful business is the best way to promote your principles." This works in the opposite direction as well. Principles, as a component of business, are a competitive advantage, as they are a core component of identity. An anchor and 7 satellites. To implement the idea of investing in initiatives that will make the world better and drive better financial returns, I employ a loose framework that I call an anchor and 7 satellites. Again, this might be passion and instincts, narrated again as strategy. The anchor, as we will see, is a fear of God and the timeless wisdom of his Torah, merged with sensible humanism. For God wants us to fear as well as love him. "You shall fear your God. I am the Lord." Leviticus chapter 19, verse 14, and chapter 19, verse 32. A satellite is launched into the sky and traverses space, but it is guided in orbit around planet Earth. Satellites increase in value as more communications pass through them. It has all but evaded our detection, that satellites have become an integral part, foundational infrastructure, of our daily functioning. These are the kinds of investments I am talking about.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?